Brad Klein here for TurfNet Renovation Report. Our guest today is golf course architect Jay Blasi, and we are grateful to Golf Preservations for their sponsorship of this podcast. Jay, we've known each other on and off for, well, I don't know, we met 15 years ago maybe at Century World. Was that it?
I think we even met before that at the Patriot.
We played
the opening round at the Patriot. So
down
we're
in Tulsa.
We're probably going on about 18 years or so. Yep.
Well, you've been very busy, first under a big name architect, now on your own, and with both new and major renovations. Most an interesting one we'll get to, Golden Gate Park in San Francisco, public 9-hole golf course. You did a lot of work at Chambers Bay, the new course on the landfill that was home to the 2015 U.S. Open, the Patriot in Tulsa, and then some major renovations, Poppy Ridge in the Bay Area or East Bay Area, Century World up in Wisconsin, Lakeside in Houston, I guess on the books coming up, Burl Oaks in the Minneapolis area, and Sequoia over on the East Bay in Oakland. So you've got, I guess your plate is full. How does one get into golf course architecture? That's, there are only 250 of you guys and 10,000 people who wish they were doing it for a living. So how did that work out from, your early fascination?
Well, I'm sure it's different for everybody. For me, golf's been a part of my life, my whole life. My dad brought a plastic club to the hospital the day I was born. He loved golf so much that he had built a putting green in the backyard. So, golf's really been a part of my life, my whole life. I was playing at 2 and competing at 4. We used to go out to eat and I'd flip the placemat over and draw golf holes in crayon. So, it really started early for me. We'd go on big family road trips and I'd spend the whole time with my face plastered to the window, just looking at potential golf holes out in the farm fields.
Yep.
The reality sunk in probably midway or late into high school. It's really all I ever wanted to do. If you really think about it, all of my notebooks were just filled with golf holes and stuff like that. But for whatever reason, I guess I just didn't think about it like a viable career or business. And so I just assumed when I went off to college, I'd go into business or do something like that. And my parents were really the ones who gave me the kick in the butt. They're the ones who said, hey, you're super lucky to have found something that you actually really love. You have to go chase this and do this. And, if you want to go into business, you can go into business anytime, but you should chase this. And so then I found out that most people got a degree in landscape architecture. I grew up in Madison, Wisconsin, and went to the University of Wisconsin, majored in landscape architecture, and reached out to pretty much every firm, everyone. This was a 99, 2000 timeframe, and pretty much there were no available jobs. And every professor in college told me, don't try to become a golf designer. That never works out. We've had people try that in the past and they kind of all discouraged it or whatever. And so luckily enough, I connected with Robert Trent Jones too and moved out to California in 2001.
And what's the first job that an aspiring golf architect has when you're working in the office of a big name designer?
Well, I spent probably a couple of years where assisting other designers, drawing plans. This was at the time when computers were just kind of coming along and AutoCAD was just coming up. So, senior designers in the office would draw a plan by hand and I would essentially scan that and trace that into AutoCAD, things like that. They might need a fancy rendering done for a presentation. So I would color plans, things like that. I tell people I'm on a reverse life cycle. I'm all grown up and I color with markers and play with big trucks in the dirt. But helping out, doing quantity takeoffs, on a plan set, figuring out how many cubic yards of cut and fill there are, or how many acres of grassing there is, things like that. So a lot of assisting other designers. And then what? So I'd put in a full day of work kind of doing that. And then there were so many projects kind of coming through the office, potential projects and things like that. I would use my nights to take a potential project and come up with my own potential routing or things like that. And then I'd leave it on the senior designer's desk. And eventually people got busy and they said, here, you have a crack at it, you know?
Tell us about the art of routing, of finding how holes fit. Is that that's a particular skill to see that, or to be willing to see it?
Yeah, I think routing to me is perhaps maybe the most underrated part of golf design. And so it all starts with the site. And in most instances, people think about building a new golf course on raw land. And when that's the case, it is highly variable depending on the land. If you have a great piece of property with a lot of natural features, whether that be a landform or a creek or a coastline or an iconic tree, whatever it might be, a lot of routing is trying to identify those great natural features and put together the golf holes in a way that takes the golfer on a compelling journey, hitting those great natural landforms. Since the crash of 08, you know, the vast majority of work has been renovation work. And when you really look at it, almost all of the renovation work that's taking place does not factor in routing at all. They're changing the bunkers or redoing the bunkers. They might be expanding or redoing greens, things like that. But for the most part, people avoid routing. And outside of, I don't know, maybe 100 or 100 and couple hundred golf courses in the United States, many of the golf courses aren't that great of a routing and really could benefit from rerouting. And so it's really about maximizing space. If you're dealing with a small property, it's again trying to first fit the puzzle pieces onto the property in a compelling and safe way. And then if you have a huge property, you know, you've all heard the story of Sand Hills where Bill Coore was out there and, you know, he said that his job was to eliminate 1,000 golf holes and pick the 18 best, as opposed to, you know, just finding 18. So it really varies from site to site.
Now, you were involved in a major rerouting, reconstruction, in effect, of Century World up in north central Wisconsin. That was your then boss's big time breakthrough golf course in some ways. I think it was best new golf course in 1982 when it opened. And 50, 20 years, 20 plus years later, it falls to you to do what you want with it. I mean, how did that come about? Because that was a major, not a blow up, but a complete rerouting.
So yeah, Century World recently hosted the 2023 Senior Open. Again, like you say, opened in the 80s. The RTJ2 firm designed it originally. It's funny how I got involved. In 2006, they had a windstorm that knocked over trees. Ironically, you know, the golf course is owned by Century Insurance Company. It's on their corporate headquarters. Ironically, they had an insurance policy on these trees. And so they reached out to the firm to see if somebody could come out and guide them on, you know, how to replant the trees that they'd lost. And I went out and I told them, don't replant and take a bunch more trees. And what I didn't think I'd ever be welcome back. Well, fast forward in 2010, they reached out and said, we're thinking about a greenside bunker renovation project. And so I came back out and went around with the GM and the superintendent at the time. And we looked, and it was clear they needed new greenside bunkers. But when we talked about it and went on our tour, it was clear they needed a new irrigation system. They needed new green complexes. Everything was kind of at the end of its useful life. So we started talking about the future and their need for investment in infrastructure and whatnot. And while we were going through that process, they said, okay, you know, take a look at the property as a whole. And is there anything that you guys would do differently, you know, 25, 30 years later? You know, how can we make this golf course the best it can be? You know, it's a public golf course. We really want this golf course to be fun and playable for the public and whatnot. And so it just provided an opportunity to look at the whole site and see. And sure enough, there were opportunities. There were some parcels of unused land, a neat peninsula out at the end of a lake. There were pockets, internal pockets that weren't being used. And there were some holes on the original golf course that didn't make a whole lot of sense, really sharp dog legs with water that you couldn't see off the tee and things like that. So it provided a real opportunity through rerouting to really take the golf course to another level and maximize the opportunities to make it the best it can be. And so it was a really fun project in 2013.
It's I think something one aspect of renovation work is a little misunderstood. If you're going to build a new bunker or a new green, it doesn't matter where you build it, it's going to cost the same. So now some grading of fairways might be an additional cost, but the marginal cost of moving a green, I think, is a lot less than most people think. I mean, how does that enter into your calculation? Do you when you're presenting, basically what you're telling your boss or your former boss at the time is, you know what, we're gonna take your golf course and it's gonna be a new golf course.
Well, at the case of Century World, we rerouted probably about 6 to 8 holes. Many of the holes stayed in the same corridor, but we redetailed them. But I've been involved in a number of renovation projects, whether it was Santa Ana Country Club down in Orange County, California, or Lakeside in Houston, upcoming work at Burl Oaks in Minnesota, or one I just finished at Poppy Ridge in the Bay Area, where when we were looking at what needed to be done to the golf course, there were significant infrastructure needs: irrigation, greens, bunkers, drainage. At the same time, they were looking at new turf grasses. When you start to list all of those different things that you're going to be investing in, you're in for, probably 10 plus million dollars. At that point, then you ask yourself the question, okay, if we're building 18 new green complexes, to your point, it doesn't really matter if the green is in point A or point B. The cost of the green is in the greens mix, it's in the gravel, it's in the drainage pipe. And so when you go through that exercise, I've found very successfully talking to many clients, hey, if we're going to make this investment now, and you're going to have downtime, those are the two hurdles, right? The two biggest hurdles are money and downtime. If you're going to have downtime, you're going to have to spend a bunch of money. This is your once in 30-year opportunity to get the routing right. And in reality, changing the routing, most people would assume that it's maybe double or triple the cost. The reality is it might be 5 or 10% more, depending on the site. If you had to do a lot more earthwork or something like that, it might end up being 20% more. But rerouting does not cost a lot more, so long as you're already planning on a major infrastructure investment.
I would assume that one of the biggest, how should I put this, when you're doing a new golf course, there's a kind of heroic mode where you have not control, but you have a lot of autonomy because you have a raw piece of land. Whereas when you're doing a renovation, you're dealing with people's memories. At a private club, some guy who hit a great shot and won a match 14 years ago still remembers the 4 iron he hit. It was the greatest shot in his life, and you're going to take that hole out. So I've always thought that it's actually in many ways more time and more difficult to do a major renovation of a golf course when you're dealing with that kind of resistance that often inheres in a membership.
There's no doubt about it. Absolutely correct. Two factors there. So one, when you mention the membership and people's attachment to the golf course that they know already, they're there for a reason. They've joined this club, they've built memories, they've had lots of times with their friends there. They wouldn't have joined it if they didn't like it. So they already like what they have, and now you're proposing to force them to spend money, take away something that they have, and give them something that they may or may not like better. So, when I start working with clubs, oftentimes it takes me a matter of weeks to figure out what the right solution for the golf course is. And it will take the club somewhere between 2 and 5 years to ultimately navigate all the political waters, to bring all the membership along. We'll do dozens of town hall meetings, educating them as to why this could be better and how it would work and how all that's going to come together. So much more challenging to do a renovation from the political side. When you're building a new golf course, you have a developer who's setting out to build a new golf course. They want a new golf course already, so much easier that way. The other thing is when you're actually in construction, you're dealing with an existing site where there's miles and miles and miles of pipe under the ground. There's other utilities that you have to think about. At Lakeside in Houston, there was a big gas line going underneath the
Right.
existing golf course, and so the grading plan needed to be adjusted so that we didn't hit the gas line and
Yeah,
things like
that
that.
would help. Yeah. And the other thing, I suppose, with depending on the extent of rerouting and construction, is in some cases you're dealing with people who are still playing golf. It's always, I find that always one of the strangest things. I find nowadays there's almost more resistance to closing the course at all than there is to spending $12, $15 million. You get the resistance from the senior most members who don't want to lose a year. And then you get other people who, like at any club, a certain percentage can't afford to be a member, so they want to hold on to it. But that, I've always found that maybe your experience is the same. The marginal, how should I put this? You don't gain much in a project by keeping it open for the sake of keeping it open if it impedes the project and raises the costs.
Correct. I think if you talk to any superintendent, any golf designer, any contractor, they would tell you that the most efficient and the most cost-effective way to do things would be to do it all at once. That's going to be your lowest overall cost, your lowest overall downtime, and the highest consistency with the work. If you break it into multiple phases, now you've got remobilization costs. You have potential for drastically different weather from one season to another. You may or may not be able to get the same crew back. So the costs go up, the overall downtime goes up, and the consistency of the work goes down. At a place like Burl Oaks in Minnesota, we're redoing an 18-hole golf course plus adding a 9-hole short course. So that's 27 greens to build in a 5-month season. And in reality, it's more like a 3.5 month season because you want to get that seed in the ground before September. So that was really not feasible to do in 1 year. We talked to a number of other projects that had occurred up in the Twin Cities. We found that most of them were successfully able to build 12 to 15 holes of golf in one season, but it was very rare to be able to build 18 holes of golf in one season. We needed to do more than that, so we're going to do that over 2 seasons. But most of the time, if the weather allows, Poppy Ridge was one season, Santa Ana was one season, Lakeside was one season, and all of those were the better for it.
Yeah, well, Burl Oaks is an interesting example because, in fact, most of the rerouting is on 1-9 anyway, and the other nine, you're going to be doing a lot of work, but you could actually play 1-9 and it doesn't get in the way of the traffic. So some of those decisions are made by the logistics and the scope of work. And there it actually segments. But it is interesting to me how much time you spend on the politics of it and the financing, maybe less the financing, but the politics of it and the memories and the resistance that people have. And I think it's actually led to I've argued now, it's led to a very different temperament by architects. I think you have to be more of a gentleman and more of a diplomat rather than the kind of heroic guy who arrives on a, parachutes in, stands on a Cadillac with a cape, and plans rolled up, looking into the future.
I think a couple different things can happen, and you've hit the nail on the head. One would be, as a designer, you could realize that the political fight is going to be significant, and therefore I'll just take the path of least resistance, and we'll redo the bunkers, and we'll add some tees, and for lack of a better term, wimp out and not fight the political fight. And then to your point, if you really want to get the most out of the property and move forward that way, then I think you have to be in for the long haul. There's a lot of hand-holding. There are a lot of internal politics. And I think each designer is different. I'm sure that there are some designers that come in and say, hey, it's my way or the highway, and that probably works for some of them. And at certain clubs, if they're run maybe more like a dictatorship, that model can fly. But the vast majority of my experience is that, the clubs have somewhat of a democratic process, and you've got to work your way through that. And it's really challenging because, the board will turn over every year. So you will have invested 6, 9, 12 months bringing one board along and getting them to a really good place. And then certain people will go off and new ones will come on. And so, at least one of the things I've learned over the years is that, hey, when we get started, we need to create a very small committee that's going to stick with this thing through the next 2, 5 years. And they're going to be in charge. We have to have some consistency if we're going to get anywhere.
It also helps to have just complete lockstep unity among the sort of triangular, the GM, the pro, and the superintendent. If there's any space or friction there, it's going to come out in a way that basically is going to stall the project. So.
Well, the superintendents can be your most valuable asset, right? Because the people at the golf course typically have a relationship with the superintendent, even if it's not personal face-to-face, they're getting a newsletter from them. They understand. For the most part, we've all heard horror stories about membership and superintendents, but for the most part, the membership recognizes the superintendent's probably their most valuable person on property. They will forget more than any member will ever know. And so, yeah, to build a strong relationship with the superintendent to make sure that you're in lockstep. Having said that, it's also uncomfortable for many superintendents, because they don't want to get into the political world. They didn't become a superintendent to deal with membership politics. They wanted to be out there growing grass and presenting great conditions. And so it's sometimes awkward to ask them to, stand up in front of a room and say, this is what we need to do, and here's why we need to do it. You don't want to throw them into the political fireworks.
No, but they, as we saw, the work you were doing setting up Burl Oaks is that the superintendent can be very effective when explaining technically what they're dealing with and how difficult it is to grow grass when you have a thatch layer, or you don't have adequate drainage, or the irrigation system doesn't reach. So, I found those sort of show and tell presentations to be very convincing from a technical point of view, because what you're asking then. So many golf courses look great, but the members don't know, the golfers don't know what the supers are doing to get it to that condition. And sometimes
No
it's
doubt.
the show, the body count and the broken heads and all the irrigation fixes that are being made.
Whether it was Nathan Peters at Burl Oaks or Terry Hutcherson, our former superintendent at Lakeside, followed up by Dane Alexander, big presentations in terms of, standing in front of people and showing them what's the difference between a push-up green and a USGA green, right? And showing them the network of irrigation that's underneath a golf hole. Most members aren't thinking anything about what's underneath the ground. Oftentimes, I'll have presentations, I'll be in front of 50 people, I'll say, how many of you know what a USGA green is? And maybe one or two or three hands will go up. And then we'll spend a couple minutes explaining to them what a push-up green is, what a California green is, what a USGA green. And then you start talking about their facility and where they're at in their life cycle and everything. And all you can literally see the light bulb go off for many of them in the room. And superintendents can be great storytellers. The physical show and tell is very powerful. I remember Nathan at Burl Oaks brought in some soil samples that
Right.
stunk. And
They
he said, here,
literally stank. They were rotting. Yeah.
come on up and take a whiff. You think this is good?
Well, you remember the one of them, they were like a little cupcake thing and it crumbled right there, and because there was no root structure to it.
was our version of the bloody glove. It didn't fit, right?
That's right. On that note, we're going to take a break. Our conversation with golf architect Jay Blasi for TurfNet Renovation Report and our sponsor, Golf Preservations.
From fairway and greens drainage to full-scale renovation work, Golf Preservations can handle your project with ease and give you the peace of mind of knowing the professionals are caring for your valuable golf course assets. Since 2005, Golf Preservations has meticulously installed over 500 miles of drainage pipe on more than 300 golf courses nationwide, always keeping disruption of play to a minimum. Visit golfpreservations.com or call 606 499-2732 to speak with us about your next drainage or renovation project.
We are back with our guest today, Jay Blasi, golf course architect based in Los Gatos, California. I guess that's a sort of suburb or just below San Francisco.
Yeah, I'm about an hour south of San Francisco. In golf terms, I'm the last town before you go over the hill to Pasatiempo.
Oh, okay. Well, that's a good one.
Is.
Our conversation with Jay Blasi is through TurfNet Renovation Report, and our sponsors are Golf Preservations. Jay, when you came into the industry, I think the assumption was that money was tight, and part of your job was to help efficiency. Does it surprise you the amount of money that some clubs are spending now? Because I'm seeing, obviously it depends on markets, but I'm seeing 15, 20, $22 million renovations that are not unusual now, particularly on the West Coast. Has the golf economy changed to the point where that's now, I don't know, acceptable might not be the right word, but it's not unusual.
No doubt, no doubt. I mean, I started in 2001, so I'm 24 years in, but I feel like there's been quite a roller coaster ride as it relates to the golf design and construction market, right? So when I started and I started working for Robert Trent Jones too, obviously a big firm doing work all over the world. And at that time, there was work all over the world. And then 2008 hits and basically everything stops and goes down to nothing, and then I go out on my own in 2012,
Good timing.
and so I go from working at a world-renowned firm to being a one-man band working out of my house, completely and totally different. So from 2012 to COVID, many clubs and golf courses were working on much smaller budgets. And the like, and COVID just changed everything. I mean, all these clubs became full, right? Right before COVID, there was all sorts of discussion about, what is the value of the private club and how many private clubs are going to go away and this, that, and the other. And COVID comes along and every private club is totally full and wait lists and all these things. So all of a sudden, 3 years into COVID, they're all flush with cash. They have all these new members at higher initiations and higher dues and all these things. And as you know, they're interested in keeping up with the Joneses. So the golf course down the street did a major renovation and they did X, Y, and Z, and they spent, $17 million, and boy, we've always been better than them, so we have to do the same thing, and it just keeps going. And the one thing that's been really noticeable is you see irrigation systems. The price of irrigation systems just goes up and up and up. It never goes back down. And so just from a pure infrastructure standpoint, nowadays on the West Coast, you're probably looking at $4 to $5 million for an irrigation system. And that's something that the golfer doesn't see.
Right. Well, partly the boom in construction and renovation now is what's the word? Prompted by the fact that for 15 years, people weren't really making those investments. They were trying to basically keep the operating budget going, and a lot of these facilities use their CapEx funds in order to compensate for shortfalls in revenue. So that caught up with them, and the irrigation systems themselves, the PVC in particular, proved, a shelf life of what, 25 years maybe before all the leaks became unmanageable.
Yep, I think you hit on two things there. So there were lots and lots of golf courses that were built in the 80s and 90s and maybe early 2000s that now are kind of coming due for infrastructure investment based on, how long the different parts of the golf course last. So that's one thing that certainly has prompted a lot of work. And to your point, many, many clubs weren't investing over the last 25 years. We had a great town hall meeting once in which I'm up there doing the dog and pony show and going through all this stuff. And, then somehow it gets opened up to the membership to share thoughts, which oftentimes isn't a good idea. But at this one, we had an older gentleman who'd been at the club for, 50 years. And clearly his voice carried a lot more weight than mine did, you know, but he got up at the end of the meeting and said, everybody here who's thinking that this is going to be too much money and that we can't afford this and that whatever, he said, we can't afford not to. You guys, everybody in this room hasn't been paying their fair share for the last 20 years and it's time to step up. And then he just walked right out the room. It was pretty impressive. So
yeah, it's always good to have the old members who were there in they have a little more credibility than the young guy who just played the latest golf course, you know, on the top 100. So,
well, we talked earlier about how it's a process and sometimes it takes 2 to 5 years for the club to ultimately get to the point where they're ready to pull the trigger and do the big project. In that time, I have found that, you know, probably the most effective advocate you can have is an older member who was vehemently opposed the first time I walked through the door. And oftentimes they will get themselves on the committee with the express intention of killing any potential project. Right. And then after 3 or 4 meetings of learning what's going on and what's going into this, become, you know, they can become a really effective advocate. We've had that at multiple places that I've worked.
I would think that given the environment of access through Google and various websites and everything from Friday to golf course, golfclubatlas.com, you know, obviously there's a lot of noise. The noise to signal ratio is a little bit overdone there, but there should be enough material where you can steer people who are curious and willing to learn. And that's certainly something that can be to your advantage, isn't it? Podcasts as well.
It's a double-edged sword. It definitely is an advantage in terms of there are good resources to point people to. I'll often give committee members or potential committee members kind of a reading list or things to think about or look at to try to help be informed. The double-edged sword of that is you also now have 200 or 300 or 400 members coming up to you and say, I heard this on this podcast and why aren't we doing this or why aren't we doing that? And so then, you know, you've got to spend an hour explaining that, you know, what they did over there made sense for them, but it doesn't necessarily make sense for us or things like that. So yeah. It's a blessing and a curse at the same time, for sure.
Yeah, that is one of the peculiarities in the golf industry is that I've always said there's just like there's no real national market. It's all regional markets. Every facility has its own structure, its own turf grass, its own culture. And part of your job, I guess, is to find out what that culture is and what's viable, what's working, what's not. That takes a lot of time. And it's for one thing, it's hard to set fees when there's so much you have to learn about the place before you can really feel comfortable working at it.
So true. I mean, by the time I'm done, you know, working on a project, I try to invest fully in each project that I take on, which sounds like a stupid tagline or whatever, but it is actually how I go about it. I kind of go all in and I eat, sleep, breathe it. And I'm dreaming about, you know, each hole that we're working on and stuff like that. And by the time you're done, you spend as much time with that superintendent or that committee chairman or the other consultants on the project for a year or two as you do with your family. And, you know, so those become very, very intense relationships and, you know, you're going to have to endure a lot of political BS and other stuff. And so one of the key factors in terms of finding the right fit, if you're a club looking for a golf designer, and if you're a golf designer picking out which projects to work on is, you know, how are the personalities going to mesh? Are these people that I really want to spend the next 3 or 4 years spending a lot of time with? And when you do pick the right ones, it makes life a lot more rewarding. And that's truly the best part of it, actually, is that, you know, there are challenges. And when you work through those challenges as a team, that is really the rewarding part.
Have you seen a growth in or change in how superintendents themselves are approaching these projects? I think for a long time, and this is a function of turf school, none of this stuff was taught in turf school. I think in turf school, you learn about pathogens and disease pressure and, you know, how to cultivate this, that, and the other. But the management skills, the construction supervision stuff, those are complicated skills. I would assume that more and more superintendents are adept at that now. I don't know if you find that.
I would say so. I think, and I think part of that might be a younger generation as well that's coming up that's maybe a little bit more comfortable with certain technologies. And you know, I've found that superintendents seem to be more proactive with their newsletters or putting videos together. Again, it's always on a case-by-case basis. You know, some superintendents, that's just really not their thing at all, and they just want to be outside focused on the grass, and that's okay. Then you just need to recognize that and identify, well, we're going to need somebody at the property level, whether that's the GM or the director of golf or a potential committee chairman or somebody like that, to occupy that role. But by and large, I've seen superintendents kind of stepping up, taking a little bit bigger role. And again, I think that's a good thing because most of the time they're probably the most trusted person on property, and that's a good thing.
How much do you rely on their input in terms of the maintainability or sustainability of a structure or a surface or a slope when you're designing a golf course? I mean, are you telling them what you want? Are you listening to the point where you maybe compromise what you'd like to do? How does that work?
Yeah, it's a great back and forth. And so, you know, I can think of many great discussions, in particular at Lakeside with Dane Alexander. We would go out, we'd be building a hole. So our shaper, Derek Dirksen's out there literally building the green. And we'd be talking about, okay, Dane, here's what I'm trying to achieve here. I want this ball, if it lands over here, I want it to feed off the green and go this way. I would much prefer to have this slope be tight mown, it'd be fairway cut, because I want the ball to really run away from the green. If we build it this steep, can you maintain that? How would you do it? And then he'd look at it and he'd say, well, I would have to use a different mower and I have to come at it this angle differently, and I'd have to educate my guys that this is how they'd have to do it, but yes, we can do it. And sometimes he'd say, you know, no, I can't do it, or you know, it'd be too tough. But he was always one of those guys who was looking to get to yes. And most of the time, you know, somebody is going to fall into one of two camps. Are they looking for a reason to get to yes, or are they looking for a reason to get to no? And Dane was always looking for a way to get to yes. But those are the types of discussions that you're having all the time. And I'd like to think that I'm flexible and practical in those matters. But you certainly do have a design vision that you're trying to achieve, and we recognize that. Not every decision we make makes the life of the superintendent the easiest. You know, sometimes the things we really want to see require more effort on their and their team's part. And so we certainly appreciate it when they can pull it off.
So, there's a lot of concern in the industry about growing maintenance costs. Obviously, 70, 60, 70% of a budget is labor. To what extent, when you're designing a course, are you mindful of whether the equipment is available, whether it's too much stress for the crew? I mean, how does that work out in terms of, and do you have to then go to the club and say, you know what, in order for this to work, your maintenance budget is going to have to go up by 12% or whatever.
Yeah, so those are all things that we talk about on the front end. We do everything in our power to plan for, to talk about. You touched on the point of the client. You know, the role, you know, my role is to help the client fulfill their goals or their dreams. Now, oftentimes it's kind of incumbent upon myself or the superintendent to kind of educate them and bring them along as to what makes the most sense. But by and large, you know, each client is different and they have different goals and objectives that they're trying to achieve. And so, you know, some clubs aren't worried about resources. They just want it to be the best, right? And then you've got others that, you know, Poppy Ridge, for example, is a public golf course. They'll probably do, you know, 50,000, maybe 60,000 plus rounds of golf. So everything from grass selection, you know, picking out a drought tolerant turf species that's going to use less water, to understanding, you know, the amount of play that's going to come. And so that factors into the design of the golf course. How much room do we have around the greens to make sure that we've got proper room for on and off walking traffic, or whether it's the fairways to allow golf carts to get in and out. So those discussions happen all the time, and we try to make practical decisions. Most of the clients that I work with are very practical, and we try to say, hey, if here's 10 things we're going to think about, these two or three are really important. We don't want to cut a single corner on these three, but we recognize you're budget conscious. Let's look at some value engineering over here. And so those discussions happen all the time.
That's great. I forgot to mention that you're a very skilled golfer. I think your current index is what, 2.9? Is that right?
It's trending up. Definitely trending up. Yeah.
Is this because of fatherhood or because of your ancillary work at Golf Week or what?
Well, it could be any of those things. Could just be that I'm getting old. I did just this week purchase new irons for the first time in 11 years. So I'm hoping that that will be the key to success. That it has nothing to do with me. It's got to be the technology, I'm
That's
sure.
That's right. Does being a reasonably good player get more difficult when you're a designer, or does it help you read the golf course in a way that, there's always a threat of information overload as we watch every week on the PGA Tour.
For sure.
How does that work for you?
Yeah, for me, it probably hinders my game. You know, when I go play a golf course, and I'm very lucky, I don't play a lot of golf, but when I do get to play, it's usually someplace really special. And so when I'm playing someplace special, it's really, really hard for me to turn my brain off. I'm constantly looking left, right, over. I ask myself, 100 times throughout the round, what would I have done over here? Or could this be better if you did this, that, or the other? So it's very, very rare that I can play around a golf and focus on my golf game and try to compete and do well. So for me, it's tougher nowadays, but I think understanding golf and knowing where to hit it and where not to hit it and recognizing that it's not how good your good ones are, but how bad your bad ones are, that all helps you. But in order to play at a high level, you have to be able to focus and execute. And I just don't focus very well. So
finally, to what extent does being able to play and with any efficiency at all for superintendent? I've always thought that it's probably a good idea to play some golf, but not to be so good at it that people think you're spending more time playing golf than growing grass. But what's the advantage to a superintendent in terms of seeing the golf course if you play it?
Well, that's a great point. I do, I could care less how well somebody plays golf. I do think it is important to play and to get out and to experience the golf course as the golfer does, right? I went around, this is probably 15 years ago, and I was playing a golf course in a desert somewhere where they had come in and, when they built the golf course, they had planted, 57,000 shrubs and bushes and plants. It was a heavily landscaped golf course. And invariably on almost every hole, these bushes and shrubs were growing up blocking tee shots and certainly blocking visibility. And it was very clear that the superintendent wasn't a golfer, because if you were a golfer and you stood on any one of these tee boxes, you would have said, this isn't right. These shrubs have grown up and they're blocking my view and whatnot. So I do think it is important to play, and it doesn't matter how well you play. It does matter how quickly you play. You can shoot 150, just do it in 3.5 hours. But but get out there and play. And to your point, I think if you play once or twice a month is enough to have a sense of what's going on. So you don't have to play a ton. You definitely don't need to be playing 5 days a week.
Right. Well, our guest today, Jay Blasi, it's always been a pleasure. I've been watching you flourish in your business for the last 15 plus years. Love to get back out there on the golf course with you. I'm one of those guys who plays in spite of the way I play. So I don't have your problem. But in any case, Jay Blasi, golf course architect based in Los Gatos, California. Spending time with us here at TurfNet Renovation Report and our sponsors, Golf Preservations. Jay, thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Brad. It's good to be with you, and let's get out on the golf course.
Yeah.